When we give government the power to make medical decisions for us, we in essence accept that the state owns our bodies. Ron Paul, December 10th, 2002.
An idea whose time has come cannot be stopped by any army or any government.
The Other and Ron Paul podcast starts now.
Welcome to the Honor and Ron Paul podcast. This is Dr. Howard Grattan with a special COVID-19 episode. Although I am a physician, I am not an infectious disease specialist. I have a rudimentary understanding of epidemiology and virology, similar to other medical professionals who are not in those specific specialties. So this is not going to be about the virus per se, this specific virus, but more just a look at some ways to think about government action in a time of crisis like this. So I want to break down this episode into a couple of different quadrants. I've made some notes so I don't get too out of line and lose my place, but I think first I'll talk about the idea that was popularized by Bastiat in the 1800s of seen versus unseen portions of the economy and human interaction, and then talk about unintended consequences of central planning in crises, talk about fear versus a sense of security, and talk about potential issues with government-mandated quarantines versus voluntary isolation, and then finish off with just a little snippet about price gouging in the time of crises. I strongly recommend that you go ahead and bring up www.honorandronpaul/EP18 or episode 18, because I am going to be commenting on several different articles, and you can see all these articles on that page. They may show up in your podcast feed under the description, and I don't know if you can look at them on your phone or whatnot, or maybe you just trust me. Of course, you shouldn't trust me, but check everything out for yourself. Honor and Ron Paul slash EP18, short for episode 18. All right, so let's start talking a little bit just in general terms of the virus. In case somebody's listening to this 5 years from now and doesn't know what this whole thing's all about. So right around the beginning of 2020, a small pocket of viral infection of the corona type, which is a fairly common respiratory infection, started in China, in the Wuhan, and it had a fairly high mortality rate and fairly high infectiousness, and it then has since spread from there. China, being a fairly domineering government, took pretty significant actions, quarantined the whole area, there's videos of spraying down everything, people being tackled because they weren't going along with the quarantine. Very little movement in and out of that province, but it got out. And I would like to bring to your attention the first article I wanted to chat about, which is about mathematical modeling of outbreaks, which is from the Washington Post by Harry Stevens. And it has several different mathematical models. In particular, the one about Chinese, which is about 3/4 of the way down in the article, simulating a quarantine zone. The big problem with quarantines, forced quarantines, is that there's a very high likelihood that the people within that quarantine are all going to be exposed and all be infected. You've seen this with fairly high rates of infection on that cruise ship, and we've seen in the Wuhan province that some of the highest death rates that we've had in different countries. Italy is coming up close behind, but China had some significant problems treating and containing that virus. They built a brand new hospital, which on the scene portion would make sense because it's a way to treat patients right there. Of course, it came at a significant expense. And the concern is that there is unseen opportunity cost, because maybe that money would have been better used to purchase more ventilators, to revamp current hospital beds, to treat people in their own home. A whole variety of different things may have been the more optimal outcome. And without that price mechanism, without people using their own resources or voluntarily pooled resources, using their own disseminated information for what's best for them at that point, it's very difficult to tell if that was the correct choice. In fact, some of the buildings that people were quarantined in China actually collapsed and caused some deaths and some significant injuries. Now, contrasting with that, we can look at South Korea, which is very similar to China in several aspects, as far as location and also initial rate of virus infection. For this, I direct you to an article in AIER, American Institute of Economic Research, by Peter Early, titled South Korea Preserved Open Society and Now Infection Rates Are Falling, dated March 12, 2020. In that, there's a couple of examples of South Korea's response. South Korea actually has fairly strong private property rights and business rights, where they're allowed to discriminate on who's allowed in to certain businesses without as much concern about being sued for discrimination relative to the U.S. Several businesses had signs that said no mask, no entry. There was minimal to no red tape in regards to testing, which is a big problem that we saw here in the United States with the testing that was initially available at a research site in Seattle, where the government, through the FDA and CDC, did not allow any testing to continue using their techniques because it was not properly certified in advance. So South Korea had drive-up testing windows very early on in the outbreak. They do have the advantage of having the experience of when H1N1 went through the area. So the population was well versed in washing hands and maintaining appropriate social distance. But as an example, one of their health ministers, Kim Gang Lip, summarized their response by saying, without harming the principles of a transparent and open society, we recommend a response system that blends voluntary public participation with creative applications of advanced technology. So they supported testing, and they also supported sites that identified where people had been diagnosed with the virus. And then as another example of quarantine-based system, shortly after that, we had Italy, which shut down almost the entire country and is having significant problems. Of note, this is all correlation as opposed to causation, and that should be thought about because there's several other features of Italy that make it more likely that it would spread. Older population, a population that tends to be seen as gregarious and touchy-feely, yeah, with the Italian hugging and kissing versus the Korean bowing and, you know, keeping your distance. So there's several things that are at play, and it's not all one or the other. But with that caveat out of the way, I want to talk a little bit about unintended consequences. So I want you to imagine and put yourself in a situation. This should be fairly easy to imagine for some people because it may be going on. Imagine that you have a cough and you're in one of these totalitarian regimes and you're worried that you're going to be cut off. You're going to be quarantined. You're going to lose your income. You might not be able to see your family. You may be locked up. You may be locked up and not really given any treatment, as what likely seems to have happened to the initial doctor in China that discovered the coronavirus and then ended up dying from the coronavirus himself, even though he was young. We'll never really know how aggressive he was treated by the government's healthcare system, since they were none too pleased with him. So what do you do in one of these situations where you don't want somebody to know that you have a cough? Do you stay at home and not go to work? What if somebody starts asking questions? Hey, why isn't he here at work? Does he have that cough? Let's send over some goons to find out. Do they show up and just try to stifle every cough and actually go to work? So you can see how there may be more transmission because people are less likely to be upfront about their medical problems, and there may be less quality treatment because people are afraid. I see similarities because in my practice of pain management, people are less likely to report to me that they're having problems with addiction, they're having problems with opioids or something like that, because there are significant consequences to admitting that within the U.S. judicial system. Could be jail time, could be losing your children, all sorts of potential problems create a barrier between that person and getting appropriate treatment because they're afraid of mentioning things. Same things can happen in a quarantine type society versus a voluntary isolation type of a situation. So for a discussion on the delays in testing, there was an excellent New York Times article, and there was it was also published in the Boston Globe by Sherry Fink and Mike Baker. At boston.com, you can get that article without the paywall of the New York Times. So with the two ideas of voluntary isolation versus quarantine, I would say that it's not obvious that government-imposed central planning quarantine is superior to voluntary isolation. And there's some early evidence that it is actually the opposite. Which brings us to the big picture of individual action and disseminated information. And then we'll talk a little bit about fear versus a sense of security. Okay, so everybody has a different situation in their life, a different amount of older people, a different amount of health problems, and it's very difficult for a one-size-fits-all answer to be established. Information is extremely important, and fortunately we live in the information age, and oftentimes what you get from the federal government is misinformation. If you look at some of the things that Trump has said, particularly during the early portion of the crisis, he was completely wrong. Oh, this is just as bad as the flu, it's no big deal, oh, we're doing a great job, oh, these guys at the CDC are amazed that I know all this stuff and I'm so smart and it's handling very well. So that is a lot of misinformation coming from a central authority. And that is always very detrimental because people need that proper information to kind of choose what they do on their own individual basis. And making proper choices, you also need to know a proper risk assessment. Not only risk assessment for yourself, but risks of infecting others and consequences for infecting others. So we have a very inefficient and distorted liability system in the United States. We have a system where you can sue somebody. You have to go through government courts. It's very difficult and expensive. Or you can say that the person committed a crime against you and you have to rely on the police. And once again, these very slow courts. It's very difficult to be made whole or to be compensated for someone's carelessness and getting you sick or actions because of the current legal system. I feel that a privatized legal system would be far more efficient and effective. A good book on this would be Chaos Theory by Dr. Robert Murphy, and he's also written some articles. You could probably just look up Robert Murphy and privatized legal. I believe Gary Chartier of La Sierra University also has some articles on this. So from my standpoint, it appears that the most effective things that have been done to prevent the spread have been done within the private sector, which would be examples of closures of large events, NBA canceling, a lot of these things that were canceled well before the government put strict restrictions. Some of the places that you would have expected to be more aggressive with cutting down on the spread would be the airlines. But once again, there are a lot of restrictions on the airlines as far as discrimination. You can't just say, we're not going to be flying anybody who's coming from China. You can't just put all of these restrictions on people. And the TSA is in control of all of the boarding procedures and the security. So what you saw as the government response is these very long lines, very packed airports, which is a very bad idea in regards to all of these people potentially being infected vectors. People are not being moved smoothly through the system. Airlines are not allowed to cut down on their liability for infecting people by having their own private screening process for who can ride on their planes and who can't, because all of that is off limits legally. So you have seen some states do some things which I think are good, which includes letting several prisoners out who've committed nonviolent crimes. Of course, I think they should all be let out if it's just some, you know, silly thing where they're only harming themselves, like drug crimes or something like that, or prostitution. Why are they there in the first place? It's ridiculous. So all of those people should be allowed to go out, because diseases run rampant through prisons. It's very close quarters. And just bad times. Other things that the governments have done right is a significant reduction in regulations. During the Democratic debate, they had a question. Did red tape and regulations harm the government's ability to fight the coronavirus? And they both said, no, of course not. That's a Republican talking point or something like that. I can't remember exactly what they said. But no, I mean, just go back to that New York Times article I mentioned previously. The testing was available. The testing was accurate, but it wasn't legal to do. It wasn't legal to roll it out on a large scale. Another excellent thing that has been done is they rolled back some regulations on who can make the medical N95 masks. There's an article in the Washington Post talking about how they can make almost a six-fold increase from their baseline simply by allowing the industrial N95 masks to be used in a medical environment. 3M also has announced that they've doubled their overall rate of production of masks. So there could be a 10 to 12 fold increase in the number of masks that are being created, which I think will then transition into the idea of gouging. So in an emergency situation, all of a sudden a whole variety of items have a much greater worth to several people. And unless the price is able to adjust to that increase in demand, you will have a decrease in supply. So people will start to hoard because they are now valuing that at a much higher price. If the price is allowed to go up 2-3 times, you're going to have much less hoarding. Much more is going to be on the shelf. And several more people are going to start manufacturing whatever that good is. The Charmin company has very little incentive to double their production of toilet paper because they're not really able to sell it for a higher price. If this was going to be a windfall and they were able to double the price of it, you would see a dramatic increase in their production. And when you think about doubling the price of toilet paper on a person-to-person impact, that's actually fairly low because toilet paper is really not that expensive. However, for Charmin, that would be a dramatic incentive because that's a huge boost in their margin rates. And then everybody's going to get into the game of making whatever that product is that's most demanded. So you're really shooting yourself in the foot if you're going to call out people for gouging prices. Now, artificially stealing a whole bunch of stuff and then selling it on the black market, or trying to monopolize a small area of supply, I would see as unethical. But also in today's modern world of fairly easy transportation is going to be very difficult. So in economics, they had this, what they call the subjective value revolution, where they were trying to figure out how does an object have value. And so Marx had his labor value. But then people realized that all these values are very subjective. Like a diamond doesn't necessarily have the same value as water. Sometimes it's dramatically less valuable than water if you're out in the middle of a desert. Similarly, toilet paper has much less value than a $20 bill, unless that's the last roll in the whole area and you are completely out of toilet paper. So right now we have this huge hysteria because people are worried they're going to run out of toilet paper because everybody's talking about running out of toilet paper. And so then everybody's worried about running out of toilet paper. Whereas if the prices were allowed to fluctuate and there wasn't all this anti-gouging legislation, then people would have plenty of toilet paper. Nobody would freak out. Since we've been talking about gouging and supply, that also reminds me of some of these very sad articles coming out of Italy where they are rationing. Rationing care. Italy has a socialized healthcare system. And so you have these decisions that are made on a top-down centralized authority. And one of those decisions was that people over 80 years old weren't going to get the ventilator. So my question is how strict is that going to be? What if there's someone in Italy who's a national treasure? What if there's someone in Italy who's over 80 but is a politician? How strict are they going to have those rules? And how arbitrary are those rules going to be? And is there anything that may not be completely void of arbitrariness, but just less arbitrary? How can you determine someone's value and someone's impact on society and whether they deserve to have a ventilator past the age of 80. I would submit to you that a less arbitrary way is if everybody in that person's life who has ever had any contact with that person was able to vote in very small amounts whether that person would be able to eventually have a ventilator and be saved. And then everybody who needed a ventilator would all have these votes tallied up to determine whether they could have this ventilator. And those votes would strictly be on whether that person has added value to your life. Does that sound reasonable? Does that sound feasible? Is there a mechanism that that could happen? Well, there kind of is a mechanism of how that happens, because in a free market where people voluntarily exchange goods, the value that you bring into another person's life is transmitted to you as money, as an exchange for your goods versus their goods, your time versus their time. So someone who has accumulated their wealth is then able to spend that wealth, and you are then able to allocate the value that that person has brought to the world, and they can choose, and their family can choose, whether they expend that value to put a person on ventilation through payments. This is not without some arbitrariness, but it's all I'm saying is that it's less arbitrary and somewhat of a feasible way to determine who gets a ventilator and who doesn't. And once again, going back to the gouging, when you have high demand and when you reduce regulations, you will have more things available. SpaceX has already talked about wanting to produce a huge number of ventilators, because Elon Musk has said they're already making these systems for their rocket ships, and they could easily ramp that up. Multiply that times 100 different other manufacturing facilities that could be changed over. But there's a lot of red tape, particularly for making something that is medical, particularly for making something that is as important as ventilators. It's very difficult to get certified as making medical ventilators, let alone medical masks. And let's say that someone isn't rich, but has enriched the world in some other way, such that people want to voluntarily exchange their own time and efforts in the form of money for someone else. Let's say Mother Teresa was still alive and she got COVID. You could have a GoFundMe to help Mother Teresa get on that ventilator. So there's a lot of other ways besides having these top-down, authoritarian, everybody over 80 is just out of luck. And the best current way of allocating those resources is through the free market, whether you like it or not. That's just the simple, cold, hard facts. All right, so we got that unpleasantness out of our way. Now let's talk about some more unpleasantness. In particular, how many people are going to die from the effects of the fear that COVID has created? Is it going to actually be more than the virus itself? And that is something that people need to think about, because there's been a lot of restrictions on the economic activities that are out there. A lot of those are non-voluntary restrictions of economic activity, and those can have a significant consequence, particularly when you have a bubble economy that's been going on since the collapse in 2008, where the Fed has injected a lot of money into this system, has kept interest rates at zero for a very long time, and has had an extremely slow increase in those interest rates over the past year or so, and was only able to get it up to 1%. They did not have nearly as many as they said they were going to. Each time they slowly increased it by 25 or 50 basis points that spooked the market, and they pulled back or slowed down. And now they've dropped it all the way back down to zero. So the credit is flowing, and the Fed has released $1.5 trillion into the banking system to be used as a basis for loans. So you have a situation where the money stock is greatly increasing. Oh, and there was another thing I just read, where the last Fed statement said they were going to reduce the reserve requirements to zero. So banks can essentially loan out almost as much as they like. And that's going to be a significant increase in the money supply. So the price of things is all based on how many dollars are chasing how many goods. So you can have inflation when you have the same amount of dollars and fewer goods, or you can have inflation when you have more dollars and the same amount of goods. I'm talking price inflation, technically. Inflation, as Austrian economics see it, is just anything that increases the money supply. But regardless, price inflation. So now we have a situation of two things happening at the same time. You have an increase in the money supply significantly, and you have these factories shutting down and a decrease in goods. You're going to likely have a significant amount of inflation as a result of this. Now, there are deflationary pressures because of the decreasing economy. And so it's going to be very muddied and very complex here in the next little bit. But it's quite concerning to me that there may be another stagflation similar to what happened in the 70s. So anytime that there is a significant recession, there are consequences, multi-year consequences that you can see. Sometimes you'll see an increase in the amount of suicides, increase in the amount of drug use, and things like that. Interestingly, there have been some studies in regards to recessions and depressions. And in industrialized countries, there is actually a paradoxical decrease in mortality, because in industrialized countries, we are oftentimes dying from having too much drinking, too much smoking, too much food. And so in recessions, with increased unemployment, people have more time to be healthy. They choose to spend less money on smoking and cigarettes. And so you have this paradoxical decrease in mortality slightly. In less developed countries, it's quite the opposite. Now, there's not nearly as much quality economic data coming out of a variety of countries, but there was one article evaluating Brazil. And when Brazil had a significant downturn over the past 10 years or so, there is an 8% increase in mortality, which is a very large number. And so it goes along with this saying of when the United States, gets the financial sniffles, the world gets pneumonia. And so this significant change in this structure is going to very much impact the poor. And when I talk about the poor, I mean really the poor. If you have an increase in the cost of manufacturing, and a decrease in transportation, so you have more scarce goods, who's that going to impact more? People in the United States, where food accounts for 10% of the budget, or people in third world countries where food accounts for 60 to 80% of their budget. So it could be quite devastating even to those countries where COVID has not nearly as much impact because they're not nearly as plugged into the world economy, Africa and whatnot. So it will be very interesting to see, and interesting and tragic to see what happens in regards to this virus popping this financial bubble, causing this massive downturn in the economy, and whether the fear that's generated from this and whether these significant restrictions on the economy that have happened, which may not have been necessary at all, ends up being much worse than the virus itself. There's already starting to be some articles coming out bringing up that point. Some people have seen this as very gauche to talk about the economy, and is it worth it to crash the economy for this virus? I think people aren't realizing that the economy can also equal people alive, because the richer you are, the easier it is to have life-saving treatments. As another example, France in the early 2000s had a heat wave that people in the United States would see as like no big deal. 10,000 people died in France because of a heat wave, because most people in France couldn't really afford air conditioners. And people don't realize how poor France is until they go and look at the pictures of Paris with all these rats running everywhere. But so the economy does matter, and the economy does impact people's lives in very significant ways. And if these top-down restrictions that many governors have been putting on these companies, and particularly companies that have the majority of the employees young and healthy, could end up being much worse. Of course, with those young and healthy workers, they would then need to have some type of an incentive to not spread it when they came home. And that's where you have the liability market and the difficulty at really working within the U.S. judicial system if someone is truly reckless with their infection and their corona. How do you prevent that? How do you become compensated for damages to you or your family because someone is wantonly spreading this virus around through poor hand washing, through visiting old folks home after they get off work at a factory or something like that? So there's a lot of these things that could be handled on a much more localized level, where people have this information that people from the top would never be able to have, in making their own individual decisions in how to stratify their own risks to themselves and to other people. Because a lot of the things that the governments are doing, particularly on the state level, don't really make a whole heck of a lot of sense, like shutting down the campgrounds in Oregon where I live. That's the perfect place that you'd want to go if you want some social isolation outside of the big city. Let's go camping. It is a lot of grasping at straws by the different governors and by the government to have this impression that they're doing something. And that's the big risk when you have a top-down decision. If they do the wrong thing, it affects everyone. When individuals do the wrong thing, it tends to affect a much smaller amount of people. So people are oftentimes worried and wanting the government to do the right thing, but they're not as worried about the government doing the wrong thing. They want action, and sometimes that is a very dangerous thing. And speaking of dangerous things, it wasn't that long ago that several people on the left thought that Trump was literally Hitler. And now he is freely flaunting very strong federal powers of controlling multiple aspects of the economy, locking people in place, demanding this, demanding that. So from the Bush legacy, the president has the ability to spy on everybody. From the Obama legacy, he has the ability to assassinate American citizens. And now the president has the ability to declare martial law and quarantine, choose where people travel, how people travel. And so there's also a lot of regime uncertainty and risks for potential totalitarian outcomes. I'm not saying that Trump is literally Hitler, but you have to look in the future. All totalitarian regimes were started with good intentions, and over time, different leaders expanded the powers until some bad actor got into the situation, and maybe not even a bad actor, maybe just someone who thought they were doing well, but thought that the only way to do it was to crack a few skulls and separate the wheat from the chaff. So you now have a situation where all of these unconstitutional actions are now set in precedent, that during a crisis, these are the powers that the federal government has, and they can do it extra constitutionally, do it on a whim, on an executive order, without a bill being passed, and that can lead to some significant problems. COVID-19 can kill several people, but government power in the past 100 years has killed 100 million people. So, you know, you got to be careful of that as well. So, in summary, we're all gonna die, but it might not be from COVID. So recently on a Sam Harris podcast, they were talking about, you know, different things that could be done and the significant funding that it was going to take in order to make a vaccine and how far off the vaccine was. And they made a little comment that this isn't something that you can make in your garage. Au contraire. So I'm going to post another article from Reason talking about the biohacking community. And it's called Biohackers Are on the Secret Hunt for the Corona Vaccine. So the biohacking community is a bunch of people on the underground who exchange information and ways of doing things outside of the FDA. Such as using CRISPR for genetic treatments and other unorthodox type treatments. And so they are crowdfunding $25,000 to start a vaccine. They have a proof of concept with the previous MERS, that's a Mediterranean respiratory virus, or Middle Eastern respiratory virus, another type of a coronavirus. That happened in the Mediterranean, Middle East area. They made one of those in the past, and now they're trying to develop one for this COVID-19. And they're all trying to remain completely anonymous because they don't want to raise the hackles of the FDA, which would shut them down immediately. I will mention that Sam Harris podcast did have a lot of very good things, and it is worth a listen. And it's Making Sense, episode 190, with Nicholas Christakis, who's an MD PhD. Oh, and the other thing about the panicking that has been going on, and related to the gouging, with this panicking and the lack of the ability to increase prices, everybody is rushing to the store, and everybody is going to the store and using the same carts, being in lines together, and it's the exact wrong thing that you want to be doing when there's a bunch of viruses that are easily transmittable to be going around. So there's a lot of problems in how this whole response has been rolled out. If we just have level heads, wash our hands, use masks when we go out for other people's protection, not our own, just in case we're one of those few people that are carriers and shedding viruses, even though we're not feeling sick. And let's just try to keep this situation as under control as we can, slow the spread down as much as we can so the ICUs can keep up, and please allow people to use ventilators that are manufactured in ways that aren't exactly to the T of FDA approval. There was just another article I should post on the link about how these ventilator filter devices were made over in Italy by a community of people that had 3D printers, and they couldn't get these specific filters. The company saw it as intellectual property, and they didn't allow them to have the blueprints, so they reverse engineered these, made these filters with a 3D printer. And you know, once again, free markets being very helpful for these types of situations. People coming together on a voluntary basis being far superior to these top-down ways of handling crises. And I'd like to end this episode 18 special on COVID-19. Oh, I should make it episode 19. No. Stick with episode 18. And then at the end, we'll turn it up to 19. No, just 18. All right, so finish this off with the Daily Stoic on Facebook, the Daily Stoic's most recent post, how a Stoic stays calm while everyone else freaks out. 1, separate things into what you control and what you don't. Focus on the smallest thing you can do right now. Examine the cost of panicking or emotional reaction, and have confidence in your ability to make the best of anything. And with that, we'll end Honoring Ron Paul, episode 18.